Setting Up Shop.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Setting Up Shop. I'm joined, as always, by my co-hosts, Heidi Jacobs and Rasmus Lowensteinsgaard. Yes, it's season two. We're in episode two, and we're going to talk today a little bit about barriers. This is something that everyone experiences, doesn't necessarily always realize it. Some are blindingly obvious, some are not so much. So we're going to talk about personal barriers, time barriers, financial barriers, emotional barriers, and knowledge barriers. But overall, the theme is kind of barriers to your progress, whether that be personal skill set or, you know, developing your shop and allowing your business to move forward. This is something that hopefully won't get too counselory, too kind of self-helpy. But if that's the way it ends up going, then that's fine too. We did mention in season one about working out your time and working out how much time you actually had available for working on your business and making sure that if you're in a relationship with someone that you have that conversation about how much time can and can't be committed and making sure it's not going to affect the other things that are much more important in your life. And that is always something that needs to be considered and revised fairly regularly because, you know, seasonally things change, family events happen, and all of that kind of good stuff. So a time barrier is something that can be fairly obvious. If, for instance, I still work full time, I get between 10 and 15 hours a week that I have available to me to work on my own stuff. So I spend some of that time recording the podcast. I spend some of that time on a very little amount of that time on marketing and nowhere near as much time as I'd like to actually making things. So these kind of things that are barriers to us being able to progress and hopefully can share through our experiences some of the ways that we've been able to tackle these and help you have ideas and ways of being able to progress as well. Not looking at any particular subject or sort of deviation within this, we're going to consider, I think the easiest one to look at is financial barrier. And we'll sort of jump between the different areas on there. And thinking of examples of financial barriers, we're not going to go right into the minutiae or the very teeny bits, for those of you who didn't hear what I just tried to pronounce, of exactly the differences in each of our businesses. But Rasmus, can you think of an example of a financial barrier that you may have had? Maybe it's, you know, how long it took you to save up for a power hammer or something like that.
Yeah, I guess in my world, that is the big one. And it is something that is specifically a power hammer in my life, is something that continues to baffle me and how much more I can do, how more efficient I can be while still being less tired and worn out at the end of the day. So in effect, it has cost me a lot of money to not really focus on saving up and investing in one earlier. But that's kind of a big thing of, it is suddenly really, really expensive not to have a starting capital.
Just thinking of this outside the box a little bit, it wasn't a case of, certainly not in your current workshop, it wasn't a case of you didn't have space for one. It was very much a case of financially making it viable for you to get one. So you had the knowledge that getting one would improve the efficiency and everything else. You had the space that you could put one in. It was purely the financial element that was holding you back. Does that sound right?
Yeah, just about. I mean, I've had a few different workshops, as my friends keep pestering me about that I move too much, which I can understand when you have metric tons of equipment or even just anvils.
Yeah.
I guess that's kind of a constraint you didn't mention, is like space. What's the space available to you? Because, not to jump too far ahead, but if you have the opportunity to grow your business, but you don't have the space to get equipment in to make things more efficient, then that's a limitation. You can't do that in the same way. And you need to work around that. The workshop I have now is the first one I feel like I actually could put in a power hammer. And it could fit well with the workflow I have. But at the same time, I could have figured something out in all the previous ones. I could have gone for a forging press instead of a power hammer. That has a lot smaller footprint. It could even have been kind of cheaper and it can do a lot of the same jobs. but it's the way it's doing it and the tempo and accessibility of it is different.
It's interesting you say you could have potentially done it in previous workshops. I think for those of you who don't know, because you haven't necessarily listened to the rival podcast that Rasmus is co-host of Third Focused, some of the previous workshops that Rasmus has had, the previous one to this one was a shared workshop, which had its own potential issues. And I don't know, but one of the previous ones before that was actually at a museum, wasn't it?
Yes.
So there were potential restrictions there, but, you know.
The museum workshop was really tiny. I had about 20 square meters, I believe it was. And a lot of that was taken up by a really, really big coal forge that we built for the space. So there wasn't any room in that space to put in a decently sized power hammer. I could have gotten a really, really tiny one, and that would have helped some. But then it would be sort of a fairly big investment for not that big of a return. It would have been an improvement, but yeah. And also, money-wise at the time, that was not something I was able to focus on.
So the question is then, although it was a financial barrier, you've moved workshop a number of times. You've invested time and effort into getting a larger workspace, being able to have all of this sort of thing. Was it fully a financial barrier, or was it also a lack of experience with using one and knowing exactly how much more efficient it would make your working?
That was a big part of it. The confidence in knowing how much this would improve my workflow.
Yeah.
And also the fact that before I were in my previous workshop, I hadn't used a power hammer really at all, despite being in the craft for 10 years. We had one small tire hammer at school when I went there. That was my teacher's. I think I used that for a total of 4 days out of that year.
Again, so for those of you who are not in the blacksmithing world and haven't Googled around this, probably worth looking up the Dirty Smith on YouTube and looking up tire hammers that he's potentially made. They are very similar to the way it's described. There is a tire involved. There is a hammer involved. It is homemade. It's very interesting to look at if you've got kind of an interest in blacksmithing or just think how things are made and engineering and stuff like that.
It is a hammer that is stupidly simple and small, and it's definitely something you could engineer and make by yourself if you're not afraid of flying bits of steel in the developing process.
Okay, so before we get too deep down the blacksmith route then, so Heidi, have you thought of something that would be similar that you've kind of felt was a potential financial barrier to progress on you? Or is this something that you've always been really well organized on, so it's not come across to you?
Well, I think when you're starting out, a lot of times you're starting out with your own capital. Like, you have your own credit, you have your own, like, maybe somebody gifted you the tools, or you started out with a small class or whatever, and you wanted to expand. One of the things that probably was more of a hurdle for me financially was when I started looking at wanting to expand my space from being just a tiny room to a larger space, and looking at that and going, do I put it on credit and get it done now, or do I decide to wait, save the money, and do it little by little? What we ended up doing was doing it little by little, because finances were a barrier for us, because I was working full time. Ben's job was kind of hit or miss whether or not he was going to be working full time. He could put the man hours in, but that didn't really mean that we had the extra capital to throw at supplies to work on the build. And I would say that was probably the, outside of the craft itself, that was probably the largest amount of money that I sunk into my business that I've ever spent, including buying a vehicle for the business, right? So,
okay. Yeah.
So it
that's quite a sizable investment.
Yeah. You're talking like this studio itself, just the enclosure portion was about $20,000 US. And so I had to look at that and go, is this something that I can absorb within the business, or is this something that builds equity on my house?
Yeah. Yeah.
Then it was, okay, well, do I look at my business and say, this is still a sole proprietorship, or do I change it to an LLC?
Yeah.
And what I had it originally, it was just under my name, and it was just, you know, a subsidiary of our other business called Slap Stuff Together.
Yeah.
And when I decided that I would have a larger space financially, it made sense for our tax codes to have the business pay rent to me as the homeowner. So we now have a dedicated area that's specifically just for the business, like doing podcasts or teaching or, you know, the actual manufacturing of the goods. So it is absolutely separate from the rest of the home. And those are all things that I took a lot of time talking to other business owners that either decided I financially can have a separate building, I can financially rent a separate space, or I need to still keep this within my home. And I think anyone looking to scale up that financial discovery is one of those things that could be, you could turn it into a hardship and not really a net positive. If you don't look at those equations of like, how much business am I doing? How many sales am I making on a regular? Is it more financially equitable for me to spend the money upfront and build a space? Is it more financially equitable for me to rent a space from someone else? Because then I don't have to worry about, you know, repairs or extra insurance. Like, you still have to have renter's insurance and business insurance and all of those things. But like, I think when you're just starting out, probably not these like big financial commitments, but even just the smaller ones can feel a little bit overwhelming. Like, how do I pay for my goods?
Yeah.
How much raw material do I need to have on hand in order to complete, you know, XYZ projects? That I think probably was the first financial barrier that I had to look at and go, you know, I have this many dollars based on the last round of sales. Do I take all of those dollars and put them into buying more material? Or do I take 50% of it and put it away and then 50% of it buy more material? You know, like, I feel like we have those situations, and then those are just like day-to-day running operational expenses. Yeah. But then you get these big orders from clients. And Ras, I'm sure this has happened to you, where you're used to making X amount of pieces per week, month, whatever. And then someone comes in, they love your stuff, and they're like, can you make 150 of these in this timeline? And you go, okay, yes, I can do that. I have enough time to do that, but I don't have enough goods. So then you have to evaluate, do I need the client to pay a percentage upfront for me to be able to go and buy the materials? Or do I have enough capital on hand where I can buy the materials and just do a contract with them in good faith that if I buy these materials, you know, they're going to pay me? And then there's the navigation of, do they pay me 50% before I even get started? Do they pay me 25%? Do they pay for the goods before I get started? Those kind of things.
Yeah.
Like, if you are running on a really shoestring budget and someone comes to you and it's a lot larger scale, those are the kind of things that you have to work through, both from a budget standpoint and also an emotional and risk standpoint, right? Like, I want to say emotional because we do get a lot more worried about money than anything else. Like, we don't worry as much about time because we just won't sleep.
Yeah.
We just won't eat. We just will get it done, right? But when it comes to money, that for a lot of makers, that feels more out of your control.
And it also feels a bit icky, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. Especially when you're asking people to pay you up front for work you haven't done yet. Like, that's taking on a burden to yourself, saying like, okay, self, if they give me this money, that means I'm committed. Regardless of whether or not you would have done it anyway.
Yeah.
If you're that type of person that that's not a procrastinator and that wouldn't kind of keep stringing your client along, it's still a difficult thing to ask for that money up front.
Yeah.
Because that ties you into a commitment. Like, yes, I'm going to do this. And yes, you are going to like it. If I do the work and I don't ask to get paid up front and they don't like it, then I feel a little bit better about myself.
It is a little bit back and forth, though, when it comes to asking money up front. Because if the project is big enough and you don't have the materials on shelf to just do the thing, then, at least in my world, the client needs to pay upfront so that I can buy the materials for this job. For me, that's a no-brainer. But that's in my world where suddenly I can have someone come and say like, oh, I want X number of meters of railing or fence. And I was like, okay, cool. That's X number of 100 kilos of materials in steel in a very specific size. I might have a few meters, maybe 10 meters of that on the shelf, but definitely not enough for the entire job. And then I need to order all of it.
Yeah. So that was really interesting. And there's a couple of things you mentioned there, Heidi, that the thought process is. So you've got a workshop that is in your house or part of your house. I've got a workshop that is the garage next to my house. And Rasmus has a separate workshop away from his house.
Yeah.
I will freely hold my hand up and say that for me, if I was doing this full time, the struggle would be getting the routine of getting up and going to work. I would have to work so hard. I would still have to make myself like a packed lunch and eat it in the workshop in order to stop myself sitting on the sofa and turning on the TV during my lunchtime. And all of a sudden, the 1 hour lunch break has become 3 hours because you've only got a couple of episodes of that thing left and that your wife doesn't want to watch anyway.
Oh yeah, that's never happened.
Because I will then know that, yeah, but like you've just said, yeah, but I'll work till like 8 p.m. tonight and make it up. So I was just wondering about that, those kind of barriers of the being at work when your workshop isn't right there. Because I know that you do the same as I do. You're like, oh, well, I can pop back when I've got like half an hour between this and this in my personal life. I can go in and I can just, if something's drying, I can like flip them over, or I can, you know, I can take these things out of, like in my experience, you know, I've applied a finish. It needs 3 hours. Then I need to buff the finish off. Well, I can apply the finish at like 5 o'clock. And then 3 hours later, when my wife and I have had dinner and we're just sort of watching TV, I'll just nip out for 20 minutes and then I'll do this little thing. And I think it requires a very understanding partner if you live with someone, or a very strong-minded person to be able to say, no, my work hours are X to Y. They are in this place. And when I am not there, I am not creating. That doesn't mean that you won't end up faffing around on the computer doing admin or marketing or something else like that. But I think there's potential there, isn't there? Because the thing being is, I know, even though I've said this, and oh, you know, in theory, Rasmus, he is going to the workshop, therefore he is going to work. But equally, I know, Raz, that you will probably still end up, you know, like going there at 8 in the morning and staying there till late in the evening. If you've got a job on, you'll just keep working. And I just wonder whether the barrier that I'm trying to think of is now that the more I talk about it, is possibly not even there for creative people. It's the barrier of being strong-minded enough to actually restrict yourself to saying, no, I need to only work within these hours, otherwise I will burn out. And otherwise, if I, every time my customers come to me and say, can you do X within this period of time? I go, yes, without saying, actually, no, I can't, because I'm already doing a 50-hour week and I need to eat, I need to sleep, I need to decompress. And then the following week, I can slot you in.
So I had a few of those conversations with customers leading up to Christmas. Mm-hmm. And that was literally the fact of I was already working 60 hours a week. And they come in and ask, oh, can you do this thing for me and have it done by yesterday?
Yeah.
And I gave them the fuck-off price and they go, okay, I'm happy with that. And then, of course, one of them actually came back to me. Sort of, he was happy. Everything was nice. I did everything exactly as wanted on time, perfectly. You pretend, but perfectly. And he also just asked out of curiosity, why was this so expensive? It was a lot more than what I expected. And I just basically told him, like, I'm already working 60 hours a week. You wanted it done by this time. That's the price it cost for me to stay here until 9 p.m.
Yeah.
And he was like, oh, okay, here's the money. Bye. So it wasn't an issue. Not for him, because priorities, he needed it. I was the only one who could do it. Like in the market, you can kind of set a price when there's no competition to some extent. But also being honest and just saying like, no, I'm not fucking you over. This is me saying, this is what my time is worth at this point.
Absolutely. So that's a way of managing, not expectations necessarily, but helping yourself not be taken advantage of. At the end of the day, if you are fortunate to have customers coming to you for commission work or repeat work, if you haven't already set some form of expectation when you initially started working with them, it's a very good idea to make people aware, hey, you're not my only customer.
Yeah.
You know, like And if you can afford to do it in a diplomatic way, where you say, I would be more than willing and happy to do the work, but these are the time constraints in which that I can work under, here's the thing. If you want it faster than this, this is the new price. And you don't tell them why, because you don't want to sound like you're making excuses. I wouldn't necessarily. You guys might disagree. But if they then say, well, why is it so much more money if I want it done in that time scale? Then the perfect justification in saying, because I'm going to have to work longer hours to do that, and that's going to eat into my personal time.
Or you might have to bring someone on to help you too.
Exactly. I mean,
it's not always just like, I'm the last man standing. It's in order to get it done in that timeline, I have to expedite goods. I have to hire somebody to courier it, or I have to offset other work that I had already bid out at this price. And now I'm have to pay somebody to do that work. So you have to cover that cost. So I, you know, as much as I like the idea of educating customers about your process and the whys, sometimes it can get you into trouble because then they're like, oh, well, you know, I would like you to do it this way, or like, I can get you the goods at a cheaper rate, or, you know, once they know the reasoning, they can possibly sometimes come in and try and manipulate the numbers by giving you other things.
Yeah.
I learned, I would like to say early on, but it's far too late, how to communicate the price to a customer. I learned that I should never tell them how long it will take me to do, only tell them when I can have it done by.
Yeah.
Because having spent 10 years at this point, swinging a hammer and getting, in all modesty, pretty darn good and efficient of swinging a hammer and manipulating steel means that that aspect of the job can go really, really fast and quickly. But that is because I spent 10 years doing it. And then also combined with the fact of I am usually already fully booked at least a few months in advance, if not actually having a 6 month plan of all the things I would like to have done going forward. Then the conversation is more, well, it is maybe just a half hour job, but it's a half hour of cutting materials and I need to clean up after the job in between. And I need to clean up afterwards and I need to do the finishing all of this. So it's like, yeah, it's half an hour of hammer swinging, but it could take 3 hours out of my day to do. And if I already work 8 hours a day, then I don't have those until way later. But if I say, on the other hand, that no, I'll have it done by the end of next week, then okay, I can do all of the small things in between waiting for other pieces to get hot. I can manage my time more efficiently, hopefully without getting too far down and into some ADHD rabbit hole, which Dan continuously reminds me that I do. I still don't believe it exists, but that's a different story. And then their expectations are managed in a way that they know exactly when to expect it to be done. And they don't have any illusions of how much I'm charging per hour. Illusion is maybe the wrong word.
I know what you mean, though. And
Yeah,
it's one of the worst questions you can get asked at a market stall. So how long did this take you to make? And, you know, I started giving the answer of about 8 years training and, you know, an hour and a half. Because there's always that element in there. And I think, I mean, we're not going to go over pricing again kind of thing. We might do in more depth on another time or if someone specifically asks us to. But I think there's certainly an amount of, for me, I don't like taking commission work. I will put off taking commission work as much as possible because all of a sudden I am constrained to a, more often than not, to a specific shape, size, design, or whatever the case may be. I'm not so much worried about the time factor of it as much as if it's something I've not made before, I have to kind of creatively psych myself up to make one. And I'll more often than not make a prototype before I make the actual thing. Because I've not made this shape before and I haven't, not necessarily an unnatural fear, but certainly there is an emotional barrier that is there of what happens if it goes wrong. Even though I know that what happens if it goes wrong, you make another one. And, you know, if someone's asked you to make something specific out of a piece of wood that's got an emotional attachment to it for them, you don't start with that piece of wood. You make sure you got a couple of other bits of the roughly the same shape and size and hopefully species. And you practice a few times first. But yeah, so for me, the kind of, I would not be able to, certainly for a good portion of time, run a business in the way you do, Rasmus, or certainly in some ways you do, Heidi, more of the wholesale kind of thing, because I need so much time to like get used to the idea of the design and how I'm actually going to physically make that design and get it ready for the person, that I don't even start thinking about materials and cost of materials and all of that kind of stuff. My brain's just frozen in the how the hell am I going to do that kind of phase, and what does it look like, and how many times have I got to send emails backwards and forwards with drawings and written descriptions or have phone calls, and you know, all of that kind of stuff. Just, it doesn't freak me out, it just makes me feel uncomfortable because I'm putting too much pressure on myself for it to be perfect at the end. And it could be something really simple, like I turned a candlestick, like a short, dumpy candlestick, out of a bit of an oak pew from a church in the village. And I turned one as I got asked, could you just make a candlestick? Someone's getting christened in the village. Yeah, sure. No, that was it. That was the only requirement. So I made a thing and I was like, yeah, okay, that's nice enough. I didn't charge a huge amount for it. It was a quick job in between other things. Didn't have to think too much about it. Done. The person who got gifted it, their older child said, well, I didn't get one at my christening. So they then came to me and said, could you make us another one? They didn't say, could you make one exactly the same? But that was the way that I interpreted it. And so all of a sudden I was like, I can, but I need that one back because I haven't even got like a photo, let alone a drawing. So I then agonized, and it took me 4 months to make the next one, even though the first one had taken me probably under 15 minutes, including the time it took me to make a little chucking point for something to go on it, you know, and that's including prepping the blank, because I was just like, oh, it's got to match. It's going to look the same. It's going to be in the same house. They could put them next to each other. Overthink. And realistically, it didn't really matter. Like, if I just said to them, does it matter if it doesn't match? And they said, no, it would have been fine. I could have done it. But I didn't ask that question. You know, I made a load of assumptions. I put the barriers in my own way, as I am very wont to do, and made it this big emotional issue. And at the end of the day, you know, they took it on and it was absolutely fine. And they liked it and it was great. And the job was done. The irony being is I never at any point spoke to them about costs, and I ended up just not charging them for the second one because that was how bad I felt after it had taken 3 months.
I guess that's like the mental barrier, right? Like, what are your mental barriers? If you're a maker, you know yourself in and out. Like, what are the things that emotionally or mentally you get hung up on that make you procrastinate in that way, or maybe make you just say no? Like, if somebody comes to you and they want you to do something and you're like, let me have a think on it, and then you come back and say no, like, what are those parameters that the barrier actually ends up being prohibitive thing? Not just I worked through the barrier, but like, have you had those experiences where a barrier has just prohibited you from even executing
all the time?
The thing.
I have a guy who I kept pushing to try and buy one of my cutting boards that I had ebonized. This guy makes gourmet sausages. He was a Michelin star chef, or rather, let me rephrase that. He worked in a Michelin level kitchen for most of his adult life. He's retired from that, and he now makes sausages that are superb. And, you know, but he will go out of his way to make ones that are obscure. Anyway, story's not necessarily about what he makes. At the end of this 3-day market that I was doing in June last year, May, June, that sort of time, kind of maybe a little bit later, I can't remember exactly when, he came to me and he said, I really, really like what you've done. I really like the process. I like the story behind it, but this one's far too small. How big can you make me a board? And he said, in fact, don't answer that question. I want you to have free, complete creative expression. Make me the largest cutting board you can with this process in it. I just need you to check for me to see if you like chop on it a lot. How deep does that process go into the wood? Is it going to affect things? Because he wants to use it when he's teaching in his schools of how to make sausages. And he wants a big board. But he didn't give specifics on size. I've got pieces of oak sat there. I've planed them. I've got them like roughly the right size, but I'm just staring at this large rectangle of really nice wood going like, I literally need to take a scrap and test it to see how the ebonizing process works. How deep does it go? Show him some videos. Are you happy with that? Yes, no. And then just finish the board. And he wants to pay me for it. And he wants to pay me for my time and my work. And I've just not done it because it's, you know, it's not, he doesn't want a fancy shape or anything. It's just a large rectangle. But I just keep looking at it. I'm like, but I don't, he's wanting something that I don't feel I'm able to give in my head. Like, I feel like mm-hmm. I need to make it this extravagant thing, or maybe it needs to be a pattern that I do with this process and it looks cool. Or can I somehow put his logo in the middle of it with this process without there being too much bleed off because it's a fluid that I'm using onto wood grain? And, you know, I'm massively overthinking it. And so I keep putting it off. And he's not chased me at all. And we've had conversations since then, and there's not been like, hey, are you ever going to do this? There's no pressure other than what I'm putting on myself. And it's a ridiculous thing. I know it's there, but it almost mm-hmm. starts to get to the point where it's like, it's embarrassing how long it's been that you kind of hope that they just forget rather yeah. than just finishing the job and then going, is that what you wanted? And actually, can you just have it? Because I'm embarrassed at how long it's taken me to do it.
I had that habit with a butter keeper.
Yeah.
I'm not a hand builder. I can hand build, but I'm primarily a wheel thrower. And I had someone reach out to me. I don't have a relationship with them. They're just, you know, an online presence of someone that said, I like what you're doing. Could you make this thing for me? And I attempted it and I didn't like the result. And then I attempted it again, still didn't like the result. And then he added some more complexity to it.
Okay.
And I was already struggling with the initial ask. And instead of me going back to him and saying, like, I'm struggling with it, I was just like, no, I'm trying to do it. It's just not my wheelhouse. I was having trouble with it drying flat for the base. Do you know what a butterkeeper is? Basically like a plate and then a yeah. globe. So originally it was just going to be one stick, and then he wanted it two stick. So it was getting larger. I was already having trouble getting the base to stay flat with a smaller piece. Threw in some complexity. I made like 5 or 6 of them. And then I think he just gave up with me, like, to get it to him. And I gave up too. Like, I never at any point really felt super excited about anything that I had made. And they're not that complicated. It's not like I can throw a butter bell, like a French butter keeper, you know, that you put the water in and then it's lidded and it's really fancy. But when it came to this seemingly simple project, I just could not. I was failing at every single step of it. I was failing on sizing the two pieces together. I was failing on getting it to dry correctly. I was failing on the glazing part. It just, like, the whole thing. And it wasn't for lack of effort. It just was, I think, maybe because it wasn't a strong point for me to begin with hand building. And then there were all these additional complexities. The barrier was a skill barrier and it was just too much of a challenge. And like, I look back at that project and I'm like, I never want to do one of those things again. Like, I don't even want to attempt it. But there's other people that are out there that, like, that's all they make day in and day out. That's all they make. They make these little butter things. They're absolutely gorgeous. They put all kinds of really cool textures on them. And there are just certain losses that I think as a maker versus like somebody that just owns a business and buys widgets and doodads from other people and resells them. Like, the fact that I physically have to make this thing, you know, I didn't put any kind of timeline burdens. I just said, never done anything like this before. I'm going to do my best to try it. I tried it and it didn't work out. And, you know, it's part of me that wakes me up at night.
Yeah.
Like, but it is something that I'm like, oh, okay, well, this is an area that I will not accept business for.
So that's really interesting that you, like, you've got to that point where you've said to yourself, my skill set is not in this area.
Mm-hmm.
But also,
I'm just too sloppy.
You've kind of almost been traumatized by this event to the extent that you've just been like, do you know what? I'm not even interested in going and learning how to do this area any better than I already can. Because I just don't want anything to do with it. Let's just step away completely.
Well, I think it's also like one of those things where sometimes taking on a project that you've never done before helps you gain a skill or level up in what you're doing, right? So it's not always bad to take on that kind of work. But if the number of hours that you're putting in to learn something results in you never wanting to do it again, then it was a net negative. It wasn't a net positive. And it was not a good time investment.
Yeah.
Now, if I had been more aware I'm the type of person that I tend to be overly optimistic at my skills. I'm not like you, Dan, where I will let my fear of this thing that I haven't done before be a reason why I'm not working on something. It actually, I think it's the opposite for me. It's a catalyst.
Okay.
It's one of those things that gets me excited. Oh, I've never done that before. Let me read about it. Let me watch all these videos and let me just do it. My husband, Ben, is similar to you, where he has to know all the problems before he even starts. And I'm like, well, I'll just fix it when I break it. Right? I'll just fix it when I break it.
Yeah. Which the worst bit of it is, having done this enough times, I know once I start the actual make, once I've kind of gone, oh, if I do this, 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 and this, this will probably happen. And once I've started the first step and it's gone well, and I've done the second step and it's gone well, and I get to the third step, which let's say it's a two-part item and I need to join the two together, and I've checked it like 8 times to make absolutely sure. And like, and when I say check it, I mean like, you know, I'm removing 0.5 millimeter of material at a time to make absolutely sure nothing's going to go wrong. And then I finish it and then I look up and I go, oh, that took me like an hour with being extremely cautious. I will then quite often, if I needed to, make a second one and it will take me like 15, 20 minutes. I'll be a lot less cautious because I've done it. Mm-hmm. And I know that once I've done it, I'm like, oh no, that's, you know, it's not necessarily, oh, that's easy, but oh, I know I can do that now.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I know that's what will happen, I still have to spend far too much time overthinking it and wanting to know absolutely everything in the background of like, you know, it's to the extent of I painted the bases on some cake stands. I spent a lot of time choosing the shade of green that I wanted, or turquoise or whatever. And there were various reasons for that, because it was, you know, it's to do with branding as well. So that's quite important. But I then ordered 8 different samples of that color of paint from different companies in different finishes. Because I didn't know whether I wanted a chalky finish, a satin finish, or a smooth finish, or a gloss finish, or whatever. So I spent like £40 on samples, knowing that I was going to throw away 7 of them.
Decision constipation.
Yeah, absolutely. But when I got the right one, I then ordered a big tin of it because I'm now all in. Like, okay, this is the route I'm going down. So now I'm all in on that. I say I threw them away, having tidied up my fire cabinet this week. All 7 little pots are still in there because they might be handy at some point in time for something. you never know. You always have to keep these things. But yeah, it's definitely a thing where, yes, there's an element of knowledge barrier, but there's certainly, and we won't talk about me the whole time because that gets very boring. But I definitely have this thing of, if I'm not good at it first time, then I may as well just give up. And would, as I've said in the past, wood turning is the first thing that I'd not done that with, and that I kept making myself go back out to the workshop and have another go. And I did training and I got personal tuition and all that kind of stuff. And so I think there's also an element of, I don't ever want to get to that point where I do something that makes me go, I'm no good at this, and I do just give up. So I've put that extra level of pressure into that situation. But steering away from this before it gets very self-helpy, which is always a danger with me and these conversations. You mentioned earlier, Heidi, when we were talking about your workshop and financially and things. So there's a book that my wife, Janie's been reading, and she keeps telling me I should read, which won't work because it's actually educational. And it's called Profit First. And it's a really interesting book where the basic premise of it, as she explained to me the other evening, is, once you have received your payment, let's say it's a monthly payment for the sake of easiness of understanding, take out the profit that you have calculated. So if you work out your pricing on an item, you've put in a profit margin, right? So let's say you've sold 100 widgets at whatever price, you know what the profit should be. So the first thing you do is you take that profit out and you put it into an account somewhere. That is your profit account. Whatever it is, you're going to end up doing it later on. We'll ignore that fact for the moment. The rest of that money there then covers paying for your materials, your rent, your bills, et cetera, et cetera. The reason for doing this, we as human beings will always spend budget that's in front of us.
Yeah.
It's the same as the workshop. We will always fill the size of workshop space that we have in front of us and want more. You'll never find someone, it doesn't matter how big their workshop is. Even Jimmy Duresta with his massive barn and his secondary barn and his probably third other workshop somewhere else, he's filled all of those spaces.
Yeah.
And overfilled them. So they're not necessarily easy to work around and like get to machinery and whatever. You will always fill the space you've got. You will always spend the budget that's in front of you. So if you remove the profit out of that amount of money first to secure it, to make sure that you don't go, oh, well, actually, I've paid myself, I've paid for my materials, I've paid for my rent. Do you know what? I think the business could do with a new vehicle, or I think the business could do with. If you take that bit out first, your profit margin, which is then going to be for future investment or whatever, then you've made sure that it's actually available. Mm-hmm. And it was a really interesting way of looking at things. I haven't delved any further into that. Numbers just are not my thing. I know enough about them to not get into trouble. And much more than that, I'm not really interested, which is not the best way for a business owner potentially to be. But
that's
I would imagine.
A business manager.
Yeah, absolutely. I need a business manager. Anyone who's out there and wants to become my business manager, I can supply you occasionally wooden objects as payment. There's definitely an element there of, well, I mean, that's a good example, isn't it? You know, I need a business manager because my barrier is lack of interest. Like forcing yourself to do a thing, like forcing yourself to do bookkeeping every year, like it has to be done if you're going to run a business. If you just don't do it, it doesn't go away. You know, the tax man will find you and it can get very messy very quickly. Steering away from that though, I've had a conversation of the day. So one of the only processes that I don't do myself, I still do on the bottom of every piece, I laser engrave my logo. And the guy who owns the laser that I go and see, who's I've always used and done a really good job with, happened to be visiting me in the day job earlier this week. And as he was leaving, he said, oh, just to let you know, my laser's broken and it's so old now, I can't be bothered to repair it or to replace it. So kind of that's it, really. So I'm now in a position where I've got to find someone else who does a service of the same standard, or I've now got to invest, as I've kept putting off and I have talked about doing, and then I've put off from doing again, I've got to invest in a machine that will be as good as the one I've already been using, because otherwise it's not going to be up to the standard I want it to be. So that's a potential barrier. Fortunately, as we've said in episode one of this season, this year I'm focusing on personal development. I'm not intending to do any markets or big sales or anything like that. So I've got a period of time in which to overthink that problem and work out how I'm going to get around that. But have you guys ever have, you know, you've suddenly got hit with that situation where something that you didn't factor in as a potential barrier is suddenly reared up and you've gone like, ah, I've now got to work my way out of this. What about you, Raz?
3 weeks ago, my normal steel supplier got bought out of Norway.
Ooh. Oh, okay.
Yeah. And like they were really nice, really good. I started to develop a really good relationship with my representative over there. He's been to the workshop a couple of times. Like we're getting to know each other. And then suddenly I get an email saying like, oh yeah, our whole Norway department has been bought out by this other company that I don't really like.
Okay.
And the company I had been dealing with, they have been really, really good, like giving me nice discounts on the steel. They could get pretty much anything I'm interested in normal construction sizes. So getting tool steel from them to make tooling has been pretty easy. And one of the things I did in my infinite wisdom is that just before I got the email of that, I developed a new tool that I want to sell. And I ordered a part laser cut for that tool to start selling to people. And I have one stick of 3 meters of the tool steel to make the dies for the guillotine. That's what I'm talking about. Special blacksmithing tool, doesn't matter what. And I had putting off for 2 or 3 years to redesign it because I was looking for someone who could deliver a good steel in a size that was easy to deal with up towards a laser cutting company. So it's lots of moving parts to get it to work. I finally got that done. And then suddenly I got told that, no, you can't get that anymore. Probably I can. Probably I just need to order directly from Sweden or something, or Denmark instead. But then you're talking more cost, maybe larger volumes to offset the cost and things like that. So yeah, I'm still working on that one.
Interesting. That's I mean, that's the kind of one where you hope that you've still got the personal number of like someone who works at the company and go, look, guys, where did you get that from?
Yeah.
You know anyone else in the country who stocks that I can speak to? And
I mean, it's not a big deal. I can talk to a lot of other blacksmiths. We can group together and do a big tool steel order. This kind of steel is often used for hammers and axes and things like that. So it is a pretty common steel. It's not too hard to get a hold of. It is just really weird that in Norway, the only real quote-unquote steel market is construction companies.
Okay.
So tool steel is not that much being sold over here.
Not imported as a general matter, of course, because, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you have a lot of companies who are dealing like with massive steel pipes, for example. That's easy to get a hold of. But I don't need that. I need solid bar stocks of things. And often I need pretty small sizes, and that can sometimes be tricky. And then you have the whole tool steel part of it as well, and or knife steels and all of that. So yeah, that's a thing I need to figure out in the future.
It's awful when that happens. During the pandemic, there was a huge shortage of a lot of supplies. Mm. Like a lot of us that depended on certain materials had to think quick about like, okay, well, I built this product to look this way, but I'm going to have to pivot because this pigment isn't available or this stock isn't available or this, like for me, it was around Christmas time, 2021.
Dude.
Clay that I ordered on the regular, they couldn't put the manganese in it because there was a manganese shortage. So they only had the clay with the grog, but it wasn't speckled. So I had to, you know, reach out to my customer base and say, I can make these, but they're not going to be speckled. Is that okay? Mm. And most people were, you know, just as long as they had something to give their employees for Christmas or something, it was fine. But I think, you know, when you're looking at things like natural disaster, like what just happened to Zach, ZH Fabrications last night, there was a tornado
that
ripped through town and it damaged his facility. So his blacksmith shop that, you know, he and his wife bought this property. They have this nice space for blacksmithing and a tree came down on the top of it last night during the tornado storm. Those are things that it's an act of God.
Yeah.
There's not really a whole lot you can do other than like not live in an area where there's natural disasters. But I mean, like here, I could get flooding. I could have a tree fall on my house. What we have here are microbursts and occasional flooding. Mm. Those things you can't control, but you do get insurance to maybe help. Doesn't always help. Like sometimes the deductibles are so high that it creates another barrier. But yeah, I think just always being able to understand when those things come up, that there's a community around you, like Rasmus is saying, like there's a community of other blacksmiths that I'm not the only one that's going to be dealing with this. So how do we work together to resolve this? And then, you know, for Zach, I'm sure he has built such a community around his business that just like when Andy Berkey's shop burned down, there were so many of us that were just like, we couldn't be there to rebuild it, but hey, you know, I'll send you some money. Yeah. Let's help get him out of this situation.
Yeah.
So it's like, be good to other people too.
That's actually a really good point to probably end this episode on, is the fact that if you can't see a clear way around whatever type of barrier is in front of you, reach out to your community and don't even go to them and go, hey, I've got this problem. If you feel confident enough to do that, that will probably give you answers a lot faster. But speak to someone you're close enough to who you think might be able to help you, or speak to a group of people you're close enough to. I wouldn't necessarily, depending on the problem, just chuck it in a Facebook group and hope that you're going to get sensible answers back, depending on the type of friends that you have. But there's definitely support out there, provided that you are you're willing to interact with other people who are like-minded. And I think that's definitely something that's been out there for, you know, quite a while, that we don't always feel willing and able to do. We don't always feel willing and able to ask for help. It can be the hardest thing, but you know what, sometimes remember that there are those of us around who have all been through very similar situations, and we might not be able to help, certainly not necessarily financially, depending on the situation, but we might be able to point you towards someone who can, or at least offer guidance, or at least give you a place to vent, or a place to kind of brainstorm and that kind of stuff. I mean, this is part of the reason why, you know, I'm a woodturner chatting to a blacksmith and a potter, because we've got three different disciplines and we all approach things in different ways. So if you've got an issue and you think, okay, I can't get a response that makes sense to me from people who do the same thing as I do, reach out to someone completely different and go, how will you tackle this problem? Right. How would you mass produce X or Y? Right. Well, I would do this, this, and this. Right. Well, I can't weld a piece of steel to the ends of my pieces. So how would I get around that problem? Is there something that I would do that, you know, allow me to get faster at this process? And it can be exceptionally rewarding. And if you get nothing else out of the series of episodes that we put out there and you guys listen to, the importance of having like-minded people that you can reach out to locally or around the world who are able to just, you know, offer you time is invaluable. So yeah, with that in mind, go on, Matt.
If it may just shoot in a little bit, because even though we are in very different disciplines, the problems we're dealing with usually are the same.
Mm.
It's all about the construct of running a business and dealing with customers and managing personal insecurities and limitations and all of those things.
Yeah.
So the craft doesn't matter. It's just having someone to talk to that has an understanding of what you're dealing with.
Let me just write that down. The craft doesn't matter, says Blacksmith. Okay. That's team shirt for series two. Craft doesn't matter.
Damn it, I walked right into that one.
Sorry, yes, carry on with your point there, Raz.
No, that was it. I just about finished it off, I think.
Okay.
Talk to people with an understanding, and it doesn't need to be inside of your own trade or craft or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. I get what you're saying. You know, it's people who are open-minded and of a similar way of thinking. It doesn't have to be necessarily a craftsperson. So, okay then, guys, with that in mind, we're going to ask the question that, you know, what's the one thing that you've kind of done to move your business forward since we last spoke? If we start with Heidi. She's sat in her really nicely finished new studio with her various bits of machinery around her.
Yes, the biggest thing, and I touched on this a little bit ago, like the biggest thing was getting the studio where I wanted it to be, and now having had an opportunity to stand at a standing wheel. That was the first time I ever threw standing up, and it felt so good. And the space is so nice, and I'm really excited to start having folks over so that they can also learn the joy of pottery. And I don't know, it feels like a really huge milestone for me. And I couldn't have done it without Ben's labor. And he built the window, he built the ceiling. He has, like, even little things that he's been doing the last few days now that the studio's in, like, he built me this record style shelf to put my bats and stuff in so that they're not just stacked on my floor after we sat down and sketched it up. You know, it feels really good to have the space to, grow. Yeah. And
but it's certainly, like, you can certainly see the spark and the, like, the grin just hiding on your face there every time. So yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Rasmus, I've had a shit eating grin for over a week.
Yeah, you have. Rasmus, what about you?
I think for me, it's just been a shit ton of tiny things. Like getting the guillotines up on the website and actually telling people about that, not just having parts sitting in the workshop. Sketching out new things that I can get from the laser cutting company that can be whole new product lines that doesn't require manual labor from me. That is something more I can resell. So yeah, I've been spending a lot of time dealing with a lot of those recently, which is sadly very vague, but it's blacksmithing related and it is tools, and I think it'll be good things. It's everything from hand tools to bolster plates. And my plan was trying to have smaller pieces of tool steel that people can buy and make their own tools with.
I believe it's traditional that on every Maker podcast with three hosts, there's normally one person who has something exciting that they can't really tell you about.
I'm more than happy to talk about it. It is just, I don't know how exciting it or understandable it is for other people.
If we ever start encouraging people to email into us specifically with questions for the podcast, which everyone, you're more than welcome to do to info@settingupshop.com, then, you know, it will be traditional that there will be some form of bad joke from an Irishman, or there will be some form of, you know, if I'm going to comment on something, it's because I've been gifted something from a person or company. So we haven't quite got that far yet. But, you know, my kind of thing really, in comparison, it's potentially quite boring. I've cleaned and reorganized most of my workshop is what I've done. And I've spoken to the guy who's going to assess me for the Register of Professional Turners in the UK and suggested a few dates, and he's going to come back to me and confirm that. So I've made progress with potentially getting a special badge and getting on a professional list and website and all that kind of stuff. And that's been the aim for this year, is kind of increased professionalism and qualifications and stuff. So there's a step towards that.
Making goals and reaching them.
Yeah. So the trick I've learned is to make really, really small goals and no time.
Hey, little bite-sized steps.
Absolutely. I should really listen to episode one of season two and learn to apply some of those techniques. So guys, if you want to find us all individually, you can find Rasmus at
lowensmid.no,
or you can find him at .com. Yeah. Or you can find him at Rasmus Lowensteinsgerd or Lowen something or other on, what's your Instagram one? I've forgotten that one now.
Rasmus Lowen.
It is Rasmus Lowen, is it? The problem is, ladies and gentlemen, is that his name is not English. And as we all know, that language is kind of the dominant one around the world, unfortunately. We won't talk about imperialistic history. But
right.
So Rasmus, R-A-S-M-U-S-L-O-E-N, that's how you can find him on there. And the picture on his Instagram is him balancing a hammer on his nose.
I almost forgot about that.
It's been years.
Yeah, yeah, I think that picture is coming up on 8 years old or something silly now.
Yeah. Yeah.
When he was 12.
Yeah, absolutely. So now he should now be balancing a sledgehammer on his nose because theoretically, yes, you know, he's got stronger.
An anvil.
Yeah, an anvil.
Yeah, on the horn.
And Heidi can be found at Whitehall Pottery pretty much everywhere, really.
Yep.
Because it's almost like she works in something to do with marketing and branding and knows how to keep things simple. And I can be found at Bevelwood UK on Instagram and website and all that kind of good stuff. And you can collectively find us at Setting Up Shop on Instagram. And I should probably start posting more things to that page. But we hope you've enjoyed this episode. Any questions, things like that, as I said, email us, message us privately. Just let us know you've listened to the podcast. Even if you just want to say, you know, you're enjoying it or ask us to talk about a specific subject, any of that kind of good stuff. Thank you very much for your time. And we'll see you again or speak to you again next time. Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.